All right, welcome to the Agile Revolution. This is Craig. We're at YAO 2014 in Sydney today, and I've been lucky enough to stumble across two experts, luminaries. I'm running out of adjectives, it's been a long day. But anyway, Mary Poppendieck and Tom Poppendieck, how are you doing?
We're great.
Very good. Thank you, Craig.
Excellent. Well, awesome to have you back out here in Australia again, and you're here for the YAO conference. Now, Murray, you're talking about scaling, and you've also done the Lean workshop in a couple of cities.
Right.
It's been a long world tour for you guys, I hear.
We left home October 3rd, and it is now December 12th or so. We're going home on Saturday, finally, after 10 weeks.
Do you guys actually remember where you live? You don't spend a lot of time there, do you?
Oh, yes.
About half of the time we're in Minnesota.
Excellent. I guess I just want to go back a little bit. I mean, most people who listen to this podcast, and certainly myself, came across you guys. You really revolutionized the way a lot of us thought by making Lean something that we just sort of perhaps read about in books or had heard about Toyota, and actually gave us the link to software. So you guys come from, Mary, you worked at 3M. Tom, you come from...
Honeywell.
Honeywell's where I encountered Lean.
So... what sort of made you make the leap? How did you kind of go, hey, this Lean thing might actually work out for software?
Well, I did management of IT in a manufacturing plant. And I did software myself when I was writing process control software. And throughout all of that time, maybe 12 years of both developing and managing software, I had never heard of this concept of waterfall. I actually had never worked from big requirements documents. We did all internal stuff, and I worked in an engineering organization, and we engineered solutions to problems. We didn't do this crazy stuff, not even in our manufacturing plant. And so when I first ran into this thing called waterfall was when I had done an early retirement leave from 3M, and I was looking for something interesting to do, and I ran across a project where there was a project manager who was waterfall and proud of it. And I couldn't figure out how it could possibly work. And of course it didn't. And I ended up being sort of rescue project manager for that project. And it was crazy. It was like, how can this work? So I thought, you know, I ought to write a book about how you could think about this differently, because this concept is pretty stupid. Mm-hmm. It was sort of, I know now what it was, is the emperor had no clothes, but nobody was willing to say it. Mm. Everybody knew it didn't work, and everybody was religiously doing it because there was no option. And so I used the Lean metaphor to explain it, because I'd just been in a manufacturing plant, and we had done this thing that came to be called Lean actually after we did it. And it gave us a new way of thinking about stuff, a way that was flow and that sort of thing. And I thought, some of those same concepts could be applied to software. So that was a good metaphor to sort of use to write about why this crazy thing called waterfall made no sense. And it gave me a sort of a framework to argue around. I don't understand why we do all these big requirements, and I don't understand all of this other stuff, so please help me why this is a good idea. So I had an advantage. I came at this with software development background, never having any clue that, or any, you know, mindset that this big requirements thing was a good idea. And I just felt like, I've always wanted to write a book. This was an interesting topic. Why don't I take it on? And so that's where it started.
Excellent. What about you, Tom? How did you sort of get into all this?
Well, my last paid employment was with a small consulting firm in St. Paul. And I also had experience with some big systems at GE as an enterprise architect. And before that at Honeywell in an engineering department, as Mary's experience was. And actually, during the time I was with this consulting firm, I and some of my colleagues invented RUP, drawing on the same sources that the Three Amigos did, mm-hmm. and had all kinds of documents of good ways to think about things. And we abandoned it, of course, when Rational published their version. And there, too, we soon found that publishing all the good ideas was not a very good idea, because nobody has the courage to subtract. Adding is always safe. Mm-hmm. Subtracting never is. I had learned long before in my time at Honeywell that Microsoft Project was a dead end. Mm-hmm. I only realized much more recently that project thinking in general is a dead end and actually kind of tied everything together. When Mary and I first got involved in this, it seemed, about 12, 15 years ago, it seemed like Agile was maybe the result of applying lean thinking to software development. Mm-hmm. And for a few years, that kind of made sense. But recently, it has become very obvious that Agile is not lean in software development. Agile is lean in a delivery organization where somebody else tells them what to do, tells people what to do. And that might be convenient because that lets you have a technical success even though you have a business failure. You outsource responsibility for the critical part, which is deciding what to do. We, in our first book, asked a question at the end of one of the chapters. And that question was, how long does it take your company to put a single change that requires only a single line of code into production? And people were profoundly embarrassed by the answer, which was typically 6 months, year and a half, to change a single line of code.
It's, and sadly, it hasn't changed a lot since you wrote the book either.
We heard from one of the speakers here that he heard us talk about that 10 years ago, and he was so frustrated because it is 1 year to change a single line of code, and I can't do anything about it. I have no control. And at this conference, he told us, now I do. He's doing microservices, and now he can control and release in a very, very short time frame. Now, the impact of the responses to that question, and many other factors, of course, we certainly can't claim sole motivation for it, but has been the whole continuous delivery movement. Mm-hmm. The realization that if we applied the same thinking to our delivery process, to the deployment process that we did to the coding process, that we could be dramatically faster, that we could implement small pieces at high speed. And this seemed to make a lot of sense. And when we first saw it in 2010, it was amazing. Mm-hmm. Now, we hardly ever run into a situation where half the companies in our classes aren't already doing it or very close to doing it. But something else has come along. It was also introduced in 2010, and that was the Lean Startup book, was published the same year. And when you combine those two ideas, you have something that I think really is the manifestation of Lean in software rich environments. And that is an end-to-end focus, where you start by focusing on the problem that an organization is trying to solve, on the opportunity that they're hoping to exploit, on the concept that an entrepreneur is trying to make into a viable business proposition. You start by thinking about what is the real problem, what are the things that we can do to learn what we need to learn in order to create a really great product. And then the agile development techniques are a helpful tool. Mm. The continuous deployment gives us the leverage to try quick and inexpensive experiments. And these experiments tell us one of two things. They tell us this works, it's worth investing more in this, or this didn't work, let's try something else. That works so much better than the old approach where you have to spend 6 months, 18 months before you can find any feedback on whether what you've chosen to do is right or wrong. And we continue to see evidence that more than half of what any person in a product management role asks a team to deliver is wrong. Mm. If they can figure that out in a few hours or a few days using continuous delivery, they still are wrong half the time. But the investment in finding out becomes 6 hours, not 6 months. Mm. Huge impact, comparable to the impact that lean has had in other domains where it's been applied.
We're hearing that, and we're hearing that message at this conference over and over, really, aren't we? It's, and it's good to see, you know, people focusing on, you know, impacts over outputs. It was in, certainly in your talk at the conference. Goyko Adzik saying the same thing. Gabriel Benefield saying the same thing.
Jess Humble saying the same thing.
Which is extremely refreshing, refreshing to hear. And now our challenge is to, I guess, to move on. And it's interesting, I guess, to note in that, in, just in, as we're talking there, how much. I think you sort of made the mention about, you know, what Agile and what Lean is and there, but I wonder if we've had to go on this journey to get there. You mentioned when you sort of started on this journey, if we hadn't gone through all the stuff that you guys put out in the early days, and if we hadn't gone through the manifesto and all those type of things, now we can have these rich conversations about continuous delivery and the Lean startup. So what's your thought about that? I mean, is the nature of Agile...
Well, I like to divide the world into... what I'm going to call delivery organizations and engineering organizations. Typically, in big companies, the IT department is what I'll call a delivery organization. And for those organizations, we had to go through this. We're still going through it because they're still grappling with this idea that this software organization off in some other part of the company, because I don't really understand them very well, is costing me money. And I want them to cost me as little as possible and give me all sorts of great things. That mindset is, I think, the cause of a whole bunch of software problems. But where you get software in a product organization, where you take a look at all of the companies that were started around the internet, none of them have that mindset. Their founders got computing. They were not afraid to type, okay? So if you look at those organizations, they didn't do quote-unquote agile. They just did good software engineering right from the start. They never looked back on how these crazy other IT organizations operated unless they were offering them tools. And so I don't think we needed to go through agile in that space. I think those guys out of the blocks got what it took to do good engineering in their product development area, and to this day those kinds of organizations, first ones to continuous delivery, first ones to catch on to this whole cycle of rapid feedback, it's a natural. Where we really did need to go through the pain, I think, was the organizations that had managers sort of deciding at what is being done in a technical area, who haven't been there, who haven't done the development, the engineering necessary to do these complex things, and who haven't a feel for the complexity of the code base and the concept of architecture and all of that stuff. And in that environment, it's still having a hard time getting through to the people who own the money that the software stuff that's done could be a very valuable tool for them. And if they get competitors from a product space that are coming at any of their product areas, they're not set up to compete because their approval process is long and drawn out and not particularly good at making tough trade-offs. Their development process might be a little faster, but are they doing the right things? If not, so what? And their deployment process is still a little bit shaky because they haven't quite got their architecture decoupled yet. So, and they're not doing these rapid feedback loops because the people who are the engineering the software are not sitting on top of the problem, understanding it, figuring out how they can solve it. They're being told what to do by somebody who is being told what to do by somebody else, and maybe two or three layers back, we get to somebody that has a problem. We have to get rid of those intermediary people. They have various titles, but what they're not doing is allowing the engineering team to be in direct line of sight to the problem they're solving. There are too many translators along the way. And Agile actually hasn't touched that problem. It has touched the flow of getting the software done, but hasn't even addressed whether or not the software is the right stuff, is solving the right problem, nor has it done very much to say, how are we going to deal with this messy architecture and allow ourselves to do rapid deployment? So those two problems in the, what I'll call the IT space, they're still not being addressed in very many companies, but the companies that are addressing them are finding they're rather remarkable levers to do really much better stuff.
But the, so given that they're not being addressed, and you mentioned a couple of them like the Lean Startup, what sort of things, if people are experiencing those types of issues, where should they be looking for guidance if it's not the Agile community?
Oh, well, I'm not sure that I have the right answer to that. I think that they should be looking first at what problems they have to solve. But I want to give you an example of one of those big companies that actually, well, their history is a little different. Think about InBank, okay? They are a bank. Maybe they're not historically a bricks and mortar bank, but they also started out with big, you know, monolithic systems that they had to change. By the way, so did Amazon. But anyway, to get back to Ing, we were just at a conference in Paris. And one of the vice presidents said, you know, as a bank vice president, we have goals, metrics, things that we're supposed to do. So we made an interesting decision. We decided that we were going to give our teams two goals, only two. And the first goal was you have to deliver something every 2 weeks. Not what?
Into production.
Something live into production every 2 weeks. And number two, you may never crash the system. Period. Mm-hmm. Only goals. It didn't say what they had to deliver or why they had to deliver. Just couldn't crash production and had to be every 2 weeks. Now, that was actually a challenge in an environment that isn't used to that. Mm-hmm. However, what they said was from the time they set those as goals, all of their management metrics went up in the right direction and very fast. Just the rapid deployment of software and getting that big flywheel going fast created a dynamic of feedback and information that caused all their bank metrics to go the right direction. So the concept of this rapid feedback instead of this big front-loaded process of we're scared we might do something wrong, somebody might spend money that shouldn't, where it shouldn't be spent. They didn't have that. They said, let's get this thing cranking, this feedback loop, so we can see the impact of what we're doing. Heavens, you can do that in software. Why not try? Mm-hmm. And once they tried, they started to do it. So I think to some extent, what Agile started to do in some places is get a flow going and rather than great big lumps. But having gotten the flow going, we haven't got it going all the way through. Problem to solution to feedback to improvement. And once we get that loop going much faster, the whole feedback loop, then you start seeing some dramatic results. Now, in some places, we might have needed Agile to get the start of that thing, but we're not all, we got to break through the ends. You know, the planning part of what are we going to do and the feedback part of getting it out there and getting the loop back. And if we don't break through the ends, it's not actually doing that much for us.
I actually remember you both, I think it might have been the last time you were out for Yale, you coined a term that I always liked, which was continuous design. You know, got Jed at that point, I think, was talking about continuous delivery, which what we refer to as in the scrum fall part.
Yeah.
But I really like that continuous design concept, and I'm just not sure there's been enough in. There's a lot of people talking about different components of that, but I'm not really sure it's come together in the same way of gone around the CD part that Jez has come up with. So, yeah, it's an interesting...
But if you look at the experience of Ing Bang, just the fact of the feedback caused the continuous design. I have seen every organization that gets that loop going, the feedback is used. When it's available, it's used. Let's take a product manager that's supposed to be God, okay? Because they have such a long feedback loop, they have to be God. And everybody thinks of them and treats them as God because that's the long 6-month feedback loop we gave them required that. You give that product manager a rapid feedback loop, and are they going to be scared of it? Oh, no. They're going to say, oh, you mean I get to test 6 ideas instead of one? How fast can I do that? I've never seen a product manager not love the idea of getting rapid feedback. So I do think that getting the results back causes the design to be so much more, so much more appropriate. Mm. You want to say something?
Sure. About 4 years ago, Yochai Beckler published a book called The Penguin and the Leviathan. Have you read that?
No, I haven't.
The Penguin, of course, is Linux, emblematic of the open source movement that has had such profound impacts for decades now. The autonomy that the people have, the degree of passion that they have for the contributions.
And the rapid feedback loops.
The rapid feedback loops that they have, intrinsic in the way they work. The Leviathan being the bureaucratic, slow, plodding, you better do what you said mentality that still dominates so much of our enterprise thinking or lack of thinking. The contest between these, Beckler posits, is coming to a head. The rate of change is increasing. The importance of the change is probably ranks up there with the invention of steam power, the invention of electricity, and other things that had huge impacts a century ago. The changes are reflected in the lifetime of Fortune 500 companies in the U.S. They've decreased from 60 to 70 years at the beginning of the last century to 15 years today. Think about that. The largest corporations in the country die, go out of business, are acquired, become irrelevant within 15 years. I cannot believe that this does not tell us something about management thinking applied in those organizations. Now, some organizations just have too much money, too much cash flow for reasons that are unrelated to their virtues. But large majority of organizations are managed in a way that is suicidal. Now, I don't think that has to be. I think it comes from the delivery mindset, from the Leviathan approach, rather than the Penguin open source agile thinking approach, lean thinking approach. The companies that survive, I believe, are going to be the ones that are able to think in an end-to-end fashion, that focus on purpose, not on revenue, not on being rich, but making enough revenue to achieve their purpose. This is going to be the survivors. The companies that insist on the Leviathan approach, the faster they disappear, the better. Helping them change is probably a hopeless task.
So that leads me to a question, and you in your most recent book, you sort of moved more towards the culture, the culture angle. Can you really change culture in an organization? Like, if I take some of those big Fortune,
I think Tom just said that's not the point. The point is not to change culture. The point is to create culture centers that work, and let the people gravitate to the culture that works for them. So I really think if companies change their culture, fine. But I don't have a whole lot of sympathy for ones that don't. I figure, fine. But there will be the people inside those companies that are going to be looking for a new culture, something that works for them. And so the idea is to create centers of good culture and then let the people find it. So I'm a little biased that way. I don't have a lot of sympathy for big, slow companies that find the competitive environment increasingly tough and say, how can we solve it? I'm looking for big companies that get that in order to survive in a competitive environment, you have to do something different, and you have to realize what your current situation is, and you have to compete effectively. And so especially, let's take telecom. Telecom lost a whole ton of money when long distance became an unviable concept, because that was a massive revenue stream that really wasn't justified by the cost of the service. Now, anywhere you see big revenue streams that are not justified by the cost of the service, they're at risk. You know, I'm paying that money, and I'd be just as happy if that revenue stream weren't heading that way. And anybody that's sitting on big, relatively unjustified revenue streams and wants to know how they can protect them, I'm not going to help them that much. I would rather see that startup company that's going to take a product approach, attack them and be successful and take away their revenue stream. And yeah, there's going to be a little job changing and stuff like that. But in the end, their culture is going to be good.
And I think that in order to get those culture centers or the types of things you talked about, Tom, requires good leadership. It requires leaders that can see that and then lead their teams.
Let me give you an example. We gave a workshop in Cape Town, way back in October 5th or something. And there was a company called SA Home Loans from Durban. And all of the companies in this class had three or four people in this workshop, and there were maybe five different value stream maps created. And these guys gave theirs, the fourth or fifth. And the other companies were banks or insurance companies. And these guys came up and showed a basically one day to get stuff thought of and delivered and out there, and it blew everybody away. I mean, not just us. They kind of taught the workshop for an hour, answering questions on how they did it. They started 4 years ago. That would be 2010 when Jez's book came out. They reorganized teams so that every team had full stack. I mean, yes, they had legacy. Yes, they had COBOL. And they had New Age, what they call New Age, and they put them in the same teams and got people to understand each other's stack. They created a very rapid continuous delivery framework, an awful lot of investment, an awful lot of problem solving, huge amount. I mean, this is not easy stuff. But they had a wonderful architect that was really, really wise that helped answer the questions, you know, like, what do you guys do about defects? Defects. You know, we don't have defects. We might have a bad spec, but we don't have defects. You know, stuff like that. So anyway, this company is attacking bank mortgages in a non-bank manner with a product environment and doing very well in Durban, top mortgage processing company in the city. And it was a really delightful environment because I know that continuous delivery is a very fun place for software engineers to work. And so I said, I'll bet you your engineers love this. And they said, yeah, it's pretty popular. And I'll bet you there's no other company in Durban that's doing this continuous delivery thing. Nope, you're right, no other one. I said, but you didn't have too much trouble keeping your folks there. He said, you know, we have had zero turnover in 3 years except the immigration. Because people love working there. So it's created a culture where engineers really have the environment that they can enjoy their job. And that's, I think, sort of why I started out this path in the first place. I loved doing software development. It's so much fun. Software engineering is a really cool thing to do. And I ran up across all these people that hated it. And I'm thinking, what's with this? What's going on here? And the goal is to create places where people find out how much fun it is and enjoy doing software engineering. And that clearly happened at that company. So if it's not about taking a really bad company and making it a little bit more tolerable. It's about creating an environment where people really enjoy the challenge and the fun part about developing software, because it can be really a wonderful. It's a lot of fun. And if people don't think it's fun, you know, they need to find a place where it is.
In the wrong place.
It's not the wrong job, I assure you. It's the wrong company.
That's it.
Most enterprises today make their decisions based on the fallacious assumption that their job is to optimize the use of capital, as if capital is the critical resource that must be conserved and maximized. I read the other day that the amount of capital sloshing around the financial systems of the world is 10 times the gross domestic product of the world.
Wow.
In other words, it's 10 times larger than anybody has any use for. Now, what is the critical resource that we need to manage today? It's clearly not capital. There's plenty of it. What is short is the passion, the energy, the concern, the engagement of bright, creative people. Now, most people are bright and creative given the right context, but that is the shortage. Survey after survey has shown that 50% of all employees are indifferent to their job. They don't really care one way or the other. what was it, 20% are actively disengaged.
Yeah.
They sabotage, and only 30% actually care about the organization that they are part of. Mm. That's frightening. Whose fault is that? It's not the employee's fault. Mm. It's not the flaw in their character. It's a flaw in the character of the way the thinking of management, of people who set policies and rules and structures that cause this, that don't permit people to be engaged, that don't allow people to care and express their care for the purpose of the organization. Mm. In fact, most organizations have the purpose that our reason for being is to enrich our stockholders. And I wonder why half the people don't care about enriching stockholders. They're not stockholders. They don't care.
Oh,
it's amazing that 30% do care.
That'll make them care, won't it?
Right.
Yeah. I don't think that this culture is something that you can influence. Mm. I don't believe it's an input. It's not a lever that you can use to change things. It's an output. But you can change its behavior. Mm. You can have different criteria. And when
different
behavior
metrics.
Changes, when metrics changes, when KPIs are either abandoned or changed to something that reflect what you really want, what the purpose of the organization really is, the behaviors will change and the culture will change. Now, the subject of change is an interesting one. People always think that the natural response to change is resistance. I don't believe that either. People don't resist change. They resist being changed. Mm. If people want to change, the change will happen rapidly and with enthusiasm. Now, why don't they want to change? Because this big change program comes along. Mm. Just like the one 3 years ago that has fizzled out. Like the one 6 years ago that has fizzled out. Mm. Change programs have always failed. Agile transformations are no different. Lean transformations are no different if they are pushed into the organization. Change happens because people want change. People want changes that they have participated in defining, in optimizing. If people have designed their own new way of working, they won't resist this new way because it's their idea. Mm. And if it isn't perfect, they're the ones that designed it, they will improve it. There's been a recent article in McKinsey Quarterly, McKinsey Insights, by
tell me the insight and I might be able to tell you the author.
Change Platform rather than Change.
Gary Hamel.
And associates. Mm-hmm. That said, change programs cannot work. Change platforms can. The change platform that they are talking about is creating a context in which every person who's part of an organization, everybody in the enterprise, becomes a problem solver. That they are trained to perceive problems, to identify which problems matter, and to solve them both individually and collectively. This is sustainable. This will work. This is the foundation that Mike Rother has identified as the very core of lean companies like Toyota. This is where all the practices came from. Mm. The practices are not important. They're their solutions to their problems encountered at the time they were developed in their particular industry. Copying those practices is not going to do any good. You have to copy their thinking, which makes everybody into an agent of improvement, everybody into a problem solver, who will identify the problems in your industry, in your country, in your context, and make things better relentlessly. That is what lean is all about. Mm. That is what is transforming the whole economy as Beckler pointed out, there's an arc of change coming. Software is both way behind, and the fact that this transformation is 30 years after it happened in manufacturing, but it's also way ahead, as the open source example illustrates.
And an awful lot of new software companies.
Yeah, absolutely. One last thing I just want to ask for before you go, you reiterated just in that discussion, you reiterated a lot of really key points that you had in the talk today about the fact that we are change agents and we have to become problem solvers, which is awesome. Well, one thing that made me think when I was just sitting in your talk was this whole military model and how the military works. Can you give us a bit of an insight into why that's important and why that might be something?
So every time we encounter really good small startup companies that have gotten to be successful, they start struggling with a problem, and the problem is that they probably started with at least the ones we've run into started with an agile model. And one of the core of that, for some reason, was teams should be autonomous. And I think it's because that was a reaction to teams being too unautonomous. But anyway, teams should be autonomous. When you get 10 or 15 teams, all of them being completely autonomous and making their own decisions on what to do doesn't actually work quite so well anymore. Even with a service architecture, you still kind of have bigger things that you got to get them to work together. How do we make that happen? And so the military model is, how do you get small squads that are truly autonomous and work as a coherent group to work together? And the military model is, you know, works around the world for the last couple hundred years. And that is, squads have an internal leader, you know, a working leader, a non-commissioned officer who actually is fighting with the rest of them, but also a leader. And the squad leader needs to work with colleague leaders and understand command intent, not one level, but two levels up. Command intent is the commander of, say, 100 of these squads. The squads are formed in groups of three squads to a platoon and three platoons in a support unit to a company. And the company commander will have an intent. We need to take this hill. And the reason why is because with this kind of height, we are going to be able to do a siege on the city, whatever it is. And then the squads collaboratively plan, okay, we're going to do the one on the west side. That's our side. And you're going to do the center. We'll do these sides here. And there's those rocks there and so on. And they do the planning. And then when you start heading for the hill, of course, all bets are off. Things are changed right away. But each squad leader knows two levels up. What's the idea? The whole company is supposed to take the hill. Ours is the west side. You know that squad over there? They're having some trouble with those rocks. Let's go over and help them. So they maintain situational awareness one level up. What's going on in my platoon? How are we coming along? Who needs help? And then understand the high-level command intent two levels up. And if you do that concept, you need to know a couple levels above, what's the purpose of what we're doing? Where does, you know, victory look? What does victory look like? What does, you know, success? What constitutes success? How do we figure it out so we can adapt and get there? And then how are my colleague teams coming along in their piece of it? We plan together collaboratively. We help each other out. And we maintain very careful awareness of how other teams are coming along so we can help them. That model has won an awful lot of battles in very unpredictable situations. We live in an unpredictable technology world. And because of the unpredictability, that same model can work well. And it has a leadership concept. It's not all about independent teams with everybody making their own decision being the only way of thinking about how people can be engaged. You know, I'm sorry, but when people get killed, they don't really like that kind of engagement. So what you need to do is have a way for teams to coalesce and work as a group, a larger group than seven people. And we've been singularly bad in some of the more interesting software companies at figuring out how to get people to work together because we're so scared of telling too many people what they should be doing. So when you get a great environment and it grows, you have to figure out how to grow a great environment and still keep it great. And that model is one way to do it.
And have you seen good examples of... Because I really like the concept of the working leader. That's something that we struggle with. That's
Why we can't have a working leader, I have no clue. Mm. It makes no sense to me. Somebody thought, they might become a mini-dictator.
Yeah, well, someone's going to shuffle
a lot of the early Agile stuff is based on some people's perception that all management are bad, and we've never quite abandoned that. Mm. But if you happen to have grown up in a company where management actually was good, it's kind of an annoying concept.
Yeah. Well, and you talk about internet startups. I mean, sometimes, you know, they're the same people who are coding the application and sweeping the floor, right?
Yep. Yes. Mm. So we have to get at, that doesn't mean that there doesn't have to be, there's got to be a lot of teamwork, a lot of people working together, a lot of getting other people's ideas. But we don't have to have this non-working, person who's not allowed to have any thought or intelligence or responsibility as the one who's sort of half in charge of the process, or I don't know what. The concept of a working leader that takes responsibility for the people that are in their squad and makes sure that the junior people have some coaching and that everybody is successful and participates is quite a good concept. It works very well, and I don't see why it's a model that we can't say. There's plenty of places where that would be a good idea.
And have you seen any examples where this has worked successfully?
Oh, heavens, that's the way we worked at 3M the time. We had line supervisors that were working, they might be one level up from the people in their organization, but every single technical person I reported to was somebody who could do my job,
mm-hmm.
and might if I happened to be sick or something like that. And that concept of the supervisor understands the job they're supervising and can provide guidance and training is a tried and true model that can work just as well as there has to be a coach that doesn't do anything.
Yeah.
Just as well.
Absolutely. Well, so many other questions I could ask you, but time's getting away from us. We talked a bit about the books before, but the latest book...
It's The Lean Mindset.
Lean Mindset, and well worth a read. I certainly had a good read through it. And,
great.
And well recommended. If people want to know more about you, what's the best place to find you on the
internet? So you have to be able to spell our last name, and then you're all set. You go to www.popandick.com, and you spell Popandick, PopPenDick.
Got it. Well, we'll put that in the show notes as well. Well, thanks very much, John Mary. It's been great to see you out here in Australia. And
great to be here.
And appreciate all the work that you do for us.
Thanks a lot.
Thank you.